Hello and welcome to The Rundown, a podcast from Politics Home. I'm your host, Alan Tolhurst, and this week, after the shock return of David Cameron to the Cabinet, we look at what the former Prime Minister's re-emergence to frontline politics means for UK diplomacy, the direction of the Conservative Party under Rishi Sunak following the reshuffle of his top team, and how exactly this bold move managed to take everyone in Westminster by surprise. Joining me to discuss this, we have not one but two of Lord Cameron's new colleagues in the upper chamber, in Baroness Kate Fall, who was his Deputy Chief of Staff during his 6 years in Downing Street, Lord Ed Vasey, a former culture minister and leading Cameroon, as well as Professor Meg Russell, director at the UCL's Constitution Unit. So I've got to say, I didn't have David Cameron to Foreign Secretary on my reshuffled bingo card on Monday morning. And obviously he brings vast experience, but also quite a lot of baggage from his time in cabinet before. Ed, obviously you worked on it. What did you kind of make of it as a kind of political move, and how much of a surprise was it when you saw him step out of that Range Rover and walk up Downing Street on Monday morning?
It was a complete surprise. I was actually on Times Radio. They do a 9 o'clock slot where you talk about the big stories in the news. And we were talking, obviously, Suella Braverman had just resigned. And then I saw Beth Rigby from Sky tweeting, you know, David Cameron's just walked up the road in Downing Street. And I thought it was a kind of trolling, you know, comedy tweet about, you know, let's have a fantasy reshuffle to start with before we start on the real reshuffle. And then it became clear that David Cameron had walked up the road in Downing Street. And then stupidly, I sort of completely missed the point. I said, you know, it could be a coincidence. He could be coming in.
Like he was there talking about
Alzheimer's research. And I should have said what was blindingly obvious, which is on reshuffle day, no one walks up the street at Downing Street unless they're getting a job in government, and certainly not a former Prime Minister. And the only job he could possibly be doing is Foreign Secretary. And I should have called it then and looked like an absolute shaman, but I didn't. I floundered around like nobody's business.
Kate, did you fare any better? Did you, obviously, like I said, you worked for him for a long time in Number 10. Did you kind of see it coming?
Well, I was actually privy to the announcement before and had chatted to him in advance. So I wasn't live on radio, as Ed just described. Look, I think it's a really important appointment. I mean, when we look around the world with the Middle East, Ukraine, Russia, where David Cameron is today, China, and we've just seen Xi and Biden meeting. There is so much going on that needs to be sorted. And here you have somebody with vast experience on the world stage. So I think a really good appointment. And I think, by the way, commendable of Rishi as well. I mean, we saw with Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, who never really wanted to put tall poppies in around him in the cabinet. And yet with Rishi, he's made this move. And I think sort of Britain, it's good for Britain, good for David, and good for the government.
Yeah, we'll kind of come on to that, though. As someone pointed out, that it's the one person who can't take his job he's put in the Foreign Office. So,
so Kate, when did Dave broach the subject with you?
Yeah.
Well, he did speak to a couple of people, as I said, over the weekend. Most of all, of course, his family, his wife, Samantha, who's his advisor, always his top advisor, and his children. But, you know, he did ask me what I thought, and I thought it was an excellent idea.
Yeah, he certainly kept his poker face at the Cenotaph on Sunday. Meg, obviously, as he's being put into the House of Lords. Just talk us through how that's going to work in practicality terms, and also, is it kind of any precedent? I don't think Lord Carrington has been talked about this much for about 50 years, but about how it's going to work with him in the upper chamber, but also being in cabinet.
Well, I mean, maybe the first thing to say is it's not unusual to appoint ministers and put them straight in the House of Lords. That happens quite commonly, but it is generally at the more junior levels. It's very unusual now to have cabinet members beyond the leader of the House of Lords within the House. If you look for precedents, I mean, one of the most obvious is looking back to when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, and he made, in rather similar circumstances in some ways, the shock appointment of Peter Mandelson, the shock return of Peter Mandelson, who was put in the Lords in order to become Secretary of State for Business. And then, of course, you've earlier on got the Carrington example. The appointment of Mandelson and then subsequently Lord Adonis as Transport Secretary under Gordon Brown did raise all sorts of questions about accountability. And the fact that these were secretaries of state that were not going to be able to be questioned in the House of Commons. And one of the strangenesses of that is that they're not facing their shadow across the dispatch box. Their shadow is in a different chamber. So it raises a difficult question about, you know, where and when does he face David Lammy, and how does that change the dynamics? At that time, there were lots of discussions about setting up alternative structures for scrutiny, and they did actually change the procedures in the House of Lords so that you could have Secretary of State questions in the Lords. And Nicky Morgan was subject to that when she was put in there very briefly as Culture Secretary a few years ago. But I think the appointment of a Foreign Secretary is a bit different. I mean, you've mentioned Carrington, who was Margaret Thatcher's Foreign Secretary from 1979 to 1982. It was not uncontroversial that he was in the Lords. And there were no structures such as those discussed with respect to Mandelson and Adonis at that time, as far as I'm aware. What they did instead was something, in a sense, far more radical, which was to appoint a second cabinet-level minister to the Foreign Office, which at that time was Ian Gilmore. And the same thing had happened previously when Alec Douglas-Hume was Foreign Secretary from the Lords before he was Prime Minister. Edward Heath was appointed at cabinet level in the House of Commons to answer questions. And I looked some of this up, and I'm afraid I have to admit, I'm quoting Wikipedia here, but what Wikipedia says about the appointment of Alec Douglas-Hume in 1960 is that by 1960, there was an expectation the Foreign Secretary would be a member of the House of Commons.
Yeah.
Eden had wished to appoint Salisbury in 1955, but concluded it would be unacceptable to the Commons. And then after discussions, they decided to put in Edward Heath in order to answer in the Commons. So
yeah.
If in 1960 it was controversial, it's certainly pretty controversial now. I actually think it's rather good that we have a former Prime Minister in the House of Lords. I wish we had more of them. Mm. We haven't actually had a former Prime Minister in the House of Lords since Margaret Thatcher died 10 years ago. So in that respect, it's good. I wish John Major was there. I wish Gordon Brown was there, you know. But the accountability question regarding the Commons for one of the major offices of state is quite a tricky question.
This next section is brought to you by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, who've just published their new landmark report, Asking Is Britain Fairer? I'm delighted to say I'm joined by the Commission's chair, Baroness Kishwa Faulkner, to look at what the 5-year review into the state of equality and human rights in the UK shows us. So Kishwa, firstly, what are kind of the top lines from the report, and what is kind of the overall answer to the question of the title, which is whether Britain is a fairer place to live now?
Thank you, Mala. I think it's really important to say that our Equality and Human Rights Monitor 2023 is not meant to come up with answers to the problems of the state of equality and human rights in Britain, but rather it's an enormous amount of research, a solid work of reference, which we think provides policymakers with sufficient data for them to be able to go back and again to look at questions that we highlight, to resolve some of the issues that they face, and to look at where the problems are and what works for them. Mm. Having said that, there are a couple of things that do come out of it. Obviously, it was a bit of a mixed bag, given the unique events and challenges, including the COVID-19 pandemic. There are some welcome advancements in equality and human rights over the last 5 years, where we made real progress towards a fairer and more equal country. But there are areas where challenges still address and new challenges would have come up.
So just on that then, in comparison with 2018, what are the kind of those, what are the some examples, I suppose, of those differences, those changes then, I suppose?
Yeah. So one of the big things was, of course, the impact of the pandemic and the impact that that had on work, for example. So the uptake in home working has been great for many parents and older and disabled people and those with caring responsibilities. But it's also brought downsides for some people, such as older people, disabled people who face social exclusion. Mm. And the higher numbers of young people who are simply reporting high levels of mental health conditions, again, possibly related to social exclusion, possibly related to not having fixed hours of being online too long. We don't know, but what we try to do is to look at the 9 protected characteristics for which we're responsible,
yeah,
and look at the trends amongst each of them.
Mm. So on work then, what have you kind of noticed with that in relation to kind of equality?
Okay, so in employment, this is a story that has been told now, that older pre-retirement age groups, which are people who are age 55 to 64, in Britain were becoming increasingly active in the labour market before COVID-19, but now are becoming increasingly inactive. We don't think there's a simple explanation. It could be health, but we simply don't have the data. There are a lot of people who are looking at that light right now. Another one that concerns us a great deal is the employment gap between disabled people and non-disabled people has narrowed, but the earnings gap between disabled people and non-disabled people has actually increased. And again, the reasons for that are not clear. On ethnic minorities, we found that most ethnic groups are experiencing improved outcomes, especially in education and employment. But Black adults have seen earnings stagnate and unemployment among Black groups remains relatively high. In education, what was really interesting, and that's related to work because they're the future work stream. In education, girls continue to outperform boys in early years in primary and secondary education across Britain. I mean, we knew that boys had been underperforming for some time, but we now see they're twice as likely to be excluded from school. And school absenteeism was also a serious issue during COVID, with nearly a quarter of children being missing from lessons for most of the time. That's what we found during the different periods of intermittent lockdowns. In autumn 2020, over 700 schools in England were missing an entire class worth of children. This is improving a little bit, but it's still worse than it was before the pandemic. A particularly sharp improvement in GCSE attainment among Bangladeshi students is worthy of note. While they experience a poverty rate of more than 40%, the worst of all ethnic minority groups, the attainment gap between Bangladeshi and white students changed from a 9 percentage point disadvantage to a 6 percentage point advantage in 2019.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I suppose kind of pulling those different strands together. And as I said, the report came out yesterday. It's full of recommendations, both to government and also public bodies and others to address those kind of disparities. What are the kind of the key recommendations that come out of the report?
So with this report, we're not prescribing what different bodies should do.
Yeah.
We've taken a different approach this time. And our recommendations are priority areas for public bodies, for government. We have the public sector equality duty that we're responsible for. So we don't want to prescribe how these organizations should be enhancing equality, conforming to the public sector equality duty, and reducing discrimination. What we're really doing is giving them the tools through the data, through our findings, through pinpointing them in the right direction. And what we're trying to do is give them the tools to look at the problems. They're the experts. They've become the subject experts. It's for them to take the material we're giving them and to run with it in terms of improving things for everyone. We've got a whole lot of broad ideas for them. Most of all, we want them to draw upon the data that we've collected by protected characteristics, the 9 protected characteristics that are our responsibility, so that we can identify unfair disparities that impact on different groups. In relation to specific protected characteristics, we call for mandatory reporting on recruitment, retention, progression, and the pay of disabled workers, ensuring that the data is split by type of impairment. And employers should really be required to publish action plans to address any disparities identified. Then we also want the government, the Crown Prosecution Service and police forces to take joined up effective action to address unacceptably low rates and charges and prosecutions of rape and sexual offences, as well as setting objectives for dealing with the higher rate of crime experienced by disabled and LGBT people. And central and local governments should create and they should report on a plan to eliminate the poverty gap between men and women by improving women's economic equality. In terms of underperformance of boys relative to girls in education, what they should do is be required to report on and again to come up with action plans to address the underperformance in primary and secondary education. These are the building blocks of future skills and employment, and it's really important that all the respective bodies, and there are a lot of different public bodies in here, actually grasp the nettle and deal with this comprehensively in a cross-government fashion. And then coming to health, governments and health providers must be required to report on and take action to address the poorer physical and mental health experienced by trans people, as well as their really poor experience of accessing healthcare, where the waiting lists are becoming longer and longer. So we look at the specific areas, protective characteristics, but we also implore public bodies to improve their data collection, because it is only by seeing the evidence that we can all move together to improve things.
Ed, what did you kind of make of that aspect of it? There's been some criticism that Sunak's looking around 360 Conservative MPs and decides he doesn't want any of them to be his Foreign Secretary. He plucks someone who's been in the political wilderness for the last 7 years. What did you kind of make of it as from that political side of it, and whether he's actually going to make maybe a few enemies within his party by doing so?
Well, first of all, it's very unhelpful of David Cameron to take the job, and I'll be having words with him, because peers who normally sit out reshuffle are now bombarded with texts saying, why hasn't Rishi Sunak put you in his cabinet? So there's a feeling of general inadequacy now coursing through the red corridors of the House of Lords. It is interesting that, obviously, the thing to say is, you know, you got a choice of 360 MPs and you couldn't find one to be your Foreign Secretary. But of course, the appointment is much bigger than that. It's about party management, and it's a gamble. And the party management is about saying, we are going to calm the centre ground Conservatives who are a bit worried about the extreme tone of some of the government's pronouncements and some of its policies. We're going to show them that we can be a team again, and that different wings of the party, including very senior figures like a former Prime Minister, can join together to work for the good of the country, which is, put it brutally, also the good of the Conservative Party. So that's what the signal is, and it sort of transcends whether or not you can decide that such and such a Minister of State could step up to be Foreign Secretary, or such and such a Cabinet Minister could step up to be Foreign Secretary. So that's obviously why he's done it. But again, he's fudged it. You know, the appointment of Esther McVeigh as the Minister for Common Sense is a kind of signal to the right that there'll still be a good old fashioned culture war that the Tories seem to love at the moment. It does send mixed messages, and I think that is Rishi Sunak's core problem. I welcomed him as Prime Minister because he's a sort of technocrat, hardworking across the detail. I mean, couldn't be more contrasting to his predecessors, but he lacks a sort of political touch and a political narrative. And if he had appointed David Cameron and not done the kind of Minister for Common Sense, it would have allowed him to develop a political narrative that the Tories were moving back to the centre ground. They were going to govern for as many people as possible. I mean, clearly for people like me, we're part of a particular tribe in the Conservative Party. So my text messages, when they weren't saying, why hasn't Rishi Sunak put you in his government, were saying, thank God David Cameron is coming back. I feel like I can now vote Conservative again. And that's a very important point that people have missed. We've obsessed about holding onto the red wall while being in a lot of danger of losing the blue wall. We're still in danger of losing the blue wall, and this will hopefully mitigate a bit.
Yeah, that's what I was going to come on to, that kind of what it says about the kind of direction of the party and what kind of voters Sunak is kind of going for. I think there was a sort, he was called the ultimate centrist daddy, and Ian Dale was tweeting that, you know, someone texted him saying that daddy's home, quite a bizarre phrase. But essentially, do you understand what it means when that happens? If the big headline out of the reshuffle is Suella Braverman's gone and David Cameron is in, what that kind of says to the Conservative base?
It says that the Conservative Party is back in the centre ground, and it says that it's going to be governing in a more moderate style. I mean, obviously, David's appointment was quickly followed by the Rwandan judgment and a very tough call, and indeed tough rhetoric on what the government is prepared to do to have a policy that will allow it to effectively repatriate asylum seekers. And it'll be interesting to see how that is handled. And again, I think to a certain extent, look, I'm pro David Cameron, so I kind of see the optimism in all of these things. It's a tricky issue, but it will, I suspect, help Rishi Sunak to calm the nerves of moderate Conservatives if somebody like David Cameron is standing foursquare with him and explaining why the policy is right, why it might work, why it's not extreme. But it'll be an interesting navigation. I don't obviously personally know David's views of the ECHR, but he had his own problems as Prime Minister with people coming through the Channel Tunnel he had to deal with, and the migrant crisis and the boats were really getting going when he was Prime Minister. So he'll be very familiar with the issues. And I assume he will obviously support the Prime Minister fully in whatever his plans might be.
And one of his key issues, yeah, we'll be speaking to people like the French, I suppose, if we're looking at kind of further returns agreement with them. Kate, obviously, as I mentioned, you and Ed are both in the House of Lords. You're about to welcome a new member. We've got any advice for the new boy? He's not been introduced to the House of Lords yet. Is there a correct way to wear your ermine or anything like that? You want advice to give him as he steps into the upper chamber?
Well, you don't actually wear your ermine very often. I mean, there is a sort of sometimes a view outside that everyone sort of walks around the House of Lords in their robes, as they're called the whole time. It only really happens once when you come in and on the King's speech. But yeah, I think he'll be in, I'm sure, sort of next week. The accountability issue, you know, is live. I remember my father actually worked for Lord Carrington. He was in the Foreign Office and was his principal private secretary. So I remember those days very well. But I think he will do his best to connect with MPs. He'll spend time seeing them. And of course, he'll face David Lammy maybe over the media rather than over the dispatch box. But look, I also think the other thing about the Lords is it is a sort of less partisan chamber. There is a sense that, although there obviously is a political chamber, there is a sense of people coming together to try and sort of talk at length, I might add, and think about issues and talk about them. And I think that will suit David Cameron's style. He is, famously a One Nation Tory, and there is a sort of atmosphere of what can we do for the, you know, for the best for the country in the chamber. So I think he will be very well received there, and I think he will enjoy it as well.
Mm. Yeah, and as you say, there's lots of people who are not aligned with any political party. There's crossbenchers. There's also going to be, there'll be four of his predecessors in David Owen, Douglas Hurd, William Hagan, and Philip Hammond. So he's going to get some pretty tough questions when he appears in the House of Lords as well.
Yeah, and people are very well informed in the House of Lords, and they do, you know, they do ask good questions. So he'll have that to look forward to.
Meg, as you talked about before, about I think Andrew Mitchell is his designated minister who's going to appear from him in the Commons. There's also been a call, I think, from people on the Foreign Affairs Select Committee to have him appear perhaps more often so that he has more chance to be scrutinised by kind of MPs. But you think is obviously the job of a foreign secretary is out in the world. Do you think it's as kind of important to have that foreign secretary there being scrutinized in the kind of lower chamber as it is perhaps, say, if you were, you know, perhaps Home Secretary or another ministry that was more focused on things happening in the UK that was more policy based?
Well, it's an interesting question. In one regard, foreign secretaries have less to do in Parliament because they tend to not have very much legislation to take through in the Foreign Office compared to the Home Office, for example, which is a very heavy legislating department. But what they do is very frequently make statements on very important matters to do with the international situation. And one of the things which has been pointed out, which is very different to Lord Carrington's day, or even Peter Mandelson's day, actually, is that urgent questions have become a very regular occurrence in the House of Commons. So, you know, you've got statements at the government's instigation, but then if a statement isn't offered, there will be an urgent question. And David Cameron is never going to be there to answer any of that in the House of Commons. I don't want to be negative about David Cameron at all. I mean, I think in many respects, you know, he's a really impressive appointment, and I think he's going to be a good addition to the House of Lords. But I think that these questions of accountability are really quite tricky. And I think, you know, once we've got over the overall shock, I was with Ed, actually. I was texting people saying, what on earth is David Cameron doing in Downing Street? Surely this must be about something else, whilst thinking, how could it possibly be about something else? So, you know, we've spent a few days thinking about that. We've been dealing with the response to the Braverman letter and the Rwanda judgment and so on. But I think that once things settle down, this question about accountability of the Foreign Secretary to the House of Commons is going to run and run. Kate is right. Questioning in the House of Lords can be very tough. You know, the House of Lords is full of a lot of quite impressive people who can, you know, people say that answering ministerial questions there is difficult. And yet, members of the House of Commons are going to feel very frustrated that they can't get the Foreign Secretary in front of them. That's the difficulty.
Yes. So, Kate, as Meg pointed out there, there's not an ability for David Cameron to appear in front of MPs if there are urgent questions and statements in the Commons. Obviously, there's quite a few live issues at the moment, the Israel-Gaza, on Ukraine. There's lots of kind of big foreign policy issues. You think that's a bit of an issue that the government's going to have to sort of iron out once we get past this week and kind of the surprise and the theatre of it all? Actually, how the mechanics of how it's going to work might be quite difficult for the government.
I mean, it's definitely an issue that he won't be in the Commons to answer questions of that sort. I mean, Andrew Mitchell will have to do it in the Commons. And to a certain extent, you might find that the Prime Minister has asked more foreign policy questions than he might have otherwise expected. I mean, obviously, David Cameron will be in the Lords and he will be out on media, you know, taking questions from all of you. But I mean, that is an issue. I mean, one thing that they could consider is obviously Andrew Mitchell could sit as an extra minister in the Cabinet. That was done. I'm going back to Peter Carrington time. I think Linda Chalker did the DFID role. And of course, there is that issue about the fact that DFID has gone into the FCDO.
Yeah.
And could you have an accountability and a minister who is accountable for that particular part of the brief? So those are some things to mull up. No sign of that now, but that is something for them to consider.
Yeah, there's quite a precedent, obviously, and there's already two other ministers in the Home Office sit at Cabinet level. So that kind of works. I think, Ed, just come back to what you were talking about earlier about kind of what this says about Sunakism. Do you think the wider reshuffle, we saw quite a lot of at the lower level, you know, ministers who had been in government for quite a while all leaving, and obviously some 2019ers all promoted. You know, what do you think the wider reshuffle said about Sunakism? And is kind of David Cameron there as more of a kind of a trusted advisor in the way that Lord Hague was to David Cameron? Or is he kind of there because, you know, he's got relationships with some of these world leaders and he can maybe get into more bilats with leaders than a foreign secretary normally could?
Well, he covers all the bases in that respect. He's got the relationship with leaders. You know, he's already seen Zelensky in Ukraine. That might be something where you would expect the Foreign Secretary to come back and make a statement in the Commons on Monday, which he obviously can't do. So, you know, Biden will know him well from his time when Obama was president.
Yeah, I think him and Netanyahu crossed paths. I think Netanyahu was Prime Minister when he was Prime
Absolutely.
Minister.
Absolutely, and Putin will know him. Not that's very helpful. Xi Jinping will know him, and the Chinese have already welcomed his appointment. So in that sense, it's good. As a trusted advisor, Kate was making the point earlier about how we would expect him to be going around sort of constituency dinners, which may be a novelty to him, speak at constituency dinners, although he's been doing it, funnily enough, since he's retired. Even in my old constituency, which is generally regarded as safe, he does events. I didn't go to the dinner he did in October. That was a missed opportunity to suck up somebody who's now very powerful.
You could have got the inside scoop as well, Ed. Come on.
And, I think the trusted advisor role is not something that people have really concentrated on, but I think it's very, very important. He's literally across the street in the Foreign Office. Rishi Sunak is teetotal, Dave is not, but a glass of whiskey and an apple juice at 11 o'clock in the Downing Street flat will be probably very, very useful to the Prime Minister going forward. So I think in that sense. And then, as I said earlier, the third role is being a kind of a bookend that says we're back in the centre ground. And I think also, to a certain extent, I think having somebody as senior and serious as David Cameron will make a few of the kind of ridiculous kind of running around of the kind of right-wing headbangers look even more absurd than it already is. And hopefully he will spend time in the House of Commons tea room talking to backbench MPs. There is a bit of stardust about him, regardless of your views of his record or what he is now. Your average backbench MP having a cup of tea with David Cameron, that's a bit of a thrill. So it will hopefully allow him to kind of continue to gauge the mood of the party and feed it back to the Prime Minister. That kind of behind the scenes, psychological, unquantifiable role, I think, is a very important aspect of his appointment.
But it's tricky. You mentioned the word bookend there. There's some people who think that it looks like the sort of appointment you make when you're in the dying days of government before you leave office. It doesn't look like a long-term promotion, a long-term decision. You know, and you say that kind of stardust is because he's an election winner. Rishi Sunak obviously became Prime Minister on sort of through a weird system. He hasn't won an election himself. Do you think that this, in that sense, it makes him look a bit bad by contrast in that sense?
Well, I think the advisory role is very important because it's quite useful to have somebody next to you who's been there and done it and can just say, put this into perspective. But Peter Mandelson's been very interesting on this, making the point that when he was appointed by Gordon Brown, which again was seen as a very surprising move and a mild tone of desperation, but Mandelson claims that his appointment was a sort of deeper appointment in terms of completely resetting the Labour government. It didn't work. Maybe it worked in the sense that there was a hung parliament rather than a straightforward Labour defeat. He doesn't believe that David Cameron has that role. I beg to differ. I think Cameron will have a more advisory role as well as his responsibilities as Foreign Secretary and will be able to work with other members of the Cabinet and backbenchers as well. But this is the point I made at the beginning, which is Rishi Sunak really has to decide now what he stands for as Prime Minister. Is he the common sense anti-woke Prime Minister, or is he the centrist Prime Minister who's doing the right things for the country? And the whole Rwandan row does not help that. I sympathise with him. It's not something he can run away from. It's something that concerns a lot of
British people, but he doesn't at the moment have the space, it seems, to develop this narrative, particularly with Suella Braverman throwing hand grenades at him, to develop this kind of centrist, calm, we're heading in the right direction, we're fixing things, we're getting Britain back on track narrative, which is really where I think he needs to be.
Yeah. Meg, as I mentioned at the start, that he does bring a lot of sort of baggage along with the kind of that experience that Ed was talking about, and obviously there's stuff around Greensill and the investigation into that, and his obviously links with China, as Ed points out, Beijing has welcomed it. Is there going to be as much chance to scrutinise a member of the House of Lords as he would be an MP?
Well, I'm sure people are going to keep asking questions about those things. I mean, not least the opposition are obviously going to make the most of that as they can. But, you know, he's clearly been propriety checked to be a minister. He's been propriety checked by the House of Lords Appointments Commission to be a member of the House of Lords. In a sense, you know, those issues are closed in a formal sense. The scrutiny point, which I keep coming back to, I think what Ed said is very interesting, that the personal stardust and the potential that he has to meet people like Biden and Zelensky, really, really important. But that makes it also quite obvious why it's very difficult to delegate. I mean, Andrew Mitchell is, you know, a very experienced minister. He sat around the cabinet table himself in his own right for a matter of years. And yet, he's not going to be in the one-to-one with Zelensky. He's not going to be in the one-to-one with Biden. So it's actually quite difficult for him to really properly fill in terms of explaining what's been going on to the House of Commons.
Right, because he's simply going to be relaying the information that he was given by the people who were in the room.
Yeah, rather less well, actually, than, say, the second-in-command to Peter Mandelson. I don't remember who that was when he was business secretary. You know, it's departmental business. It's not personal business. Lindsay Hoyle has expressed concern about how the accountability to the House of Commons is going to work. And he says he asked clerks to go away and look at how it can be dealt with. When Mandelson was appointed, the House of Commons Procedure Committee eventually looked at this and proposed that there would be some questioning in Westminster Hall. So I think the Commons is going to get back to those kinds of questions, and there probably will need to be some sort of special procedure set up. Whether it's going to satisfy MPs or not, I don't know. You know, it's not the job, particularly of opposition MPs, to be satisfied. But I think probably there will be some change, and this is going to be under quite sort of vigorous discussion in the weeks ahead, I imagine, behind the scenes in the Commons.
I think that's right. I think Meg's right. I think they will invent something maybe new, or you could imagine a committee room, and, you know, because obviously his own MP, the Tory MPs, will be able to ask him questions, but it's actually the opposition that's the problem. I just wanted to pick up with one point that Ed said before about the trusted advisory thing. My experience for having been sort of 11 years working for David Cameron, six of them in number 10, is there is a loneliness of power at the top, especially when you come into a general election. There is a sense that the weight of that choice sort of stays with you. It's very personal. And you also, it's almost physical. You can see someone sort of augment with power and then be diminished by the thought that they're going to lose it, and that they are at fault, or they've led their party into that election. So I think for Rishi, there is a real sense of someone being there who understands that unique experience of going into a general election, which I think is really important. And a second point I wanted to mention was about, I talked about sort of instability in the world, but another point to add to that is next year, there are a number of very important elections all over the world, India, Taiwan, USA,
an
election. There is a worry that there's going to be a sort of vacuum of power and leadership, especially with the USA going into this very difficult election. I think having someone like David Cameron, the sort of five eyes or security state, probably quite worried about that. I think having strong foreign secretary in David Cameron and also in Blinken next year, all the more important.
Ed, a bit closer to home, you sort of talked about Sunak and what he wants to sort of that centre ground, the talk of him being sort of like a Brexity Cameron. But then if you bring back David Cameron, that's going to annoy the people who supported Brexit, and the feeling is that the Remain cabal getting back in charge, not to go sort of all Nadine Dorries the movement on it. But, you know, there is that kind of fear, I think, from some of those MPs. And as you say, what's that strategy? I think that contrast with America, some Democratic strategists this week were saying, you know, they know exactly the voters they need to win the next election. It's who voted for Joe Biden in 2020 and who voted in the midterms. You know, who does Sunak want and who does he need to vote for him? Is it the coalition that Boris Johnson put together in 2019? Is it the coalition that David Cameron put together in 2015? Or is it a new electoral coalition? And if so, you know, how is he building towards that with this appointment?
Well, I love Meg's phrase, the job of the opposition never to be satisfied. And it's the job of the right wing of the Tory party never to be satisfied. So
that is true.
Nothing that Rishi Sunak does will satisfy them, because they're kind of completely off the reservation. And this may sound defeatist, but I think the 2019 coalition was a unique moment in British politics, the combination of Boris Johnson with this extraordinary reach across political divide and Jeremy Corbyn as the Labour leader gave Labour voters permission in the North to vote Conservative for the first time. I don't know whether that coalition would have held together if Boris had proved to be a great Prime Minister and gone into the next election as our Prime Minister. I suspect it would have had a big impact because Keir Starmer certainly hasn't sealed the deal. And I think that Rishi Sunak will have more difficulty, particularly with the unhelpful noises off from the right wing of the Conservative Party. In my view, therefore, his job is to effectively have the Cameron coalition, to have the blue wall seats voting again Conservative, heading off a Lib Dem threat. You've also got to remember, unfortunately, that somewhat because of what Suella Braverman and her team are doing, you might see Reform UK, the kind of, you know, UKIP cousin, getting votes that could have an impact on red wall seats, many of which have very small majorities. So I'm not suggesting for a minute that any Prime Minister would give up on the seats that he or she holds, but it is, it seems to me, the traditional Conservative vote that Rishi Sunak needs to concentrate on, make sure they get out and make sure that he gets those seats to return Conservative MPs. All is not lost. One assumes that the Tories will lose the next election. There may be a hung parliament, but it seems to me that is the only strategy Rishi Sunak can do. And he's got to go all in. And to a certain extent as well, I think it would be helpful if he faced down the right. If he can show that he's strong on immigration and has policies that could work, he can take them on every other aspect, in my view.
Well, just final question then, Ed and Kate, you close your ears because two members of the House of Lords. I was going to ask about House of Lords reform to Meg, and obviously you'd written previously about kind of David Cameron's attitude towards the House of Lords, and you wrote a blog saying that he's trying to destroy the House of Lords, and now he finds himself a member of the House of Lords. So I just wondered what you kind of made of that, David Cameron now becoming in the upper chamber in that sense.
That's interesting that you dug out that blog. I was actually discussing with a colleague the other day. Goodness, did I actually name David Cameron in the title of that blog?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
The reason that I said that was about the level of his appointments to the House of Lords, because the biggest problem, in my view, that we have with the House of Lords is that we have unrestrained prime ministerial appointments, which means that not only can too many people be put in there and it becomes sort of embarrassingly large and the subject of ridicule in the media, but also there's inadequate quality checking on people going in, and we don't have any mechanism for deciding the party balance in the place. And in the last 14 years, we've seen far too many peers appointed, and the tilt has been too much towards the Conservatives. So the Conservatives are now way ahead of Labour, which if Labour do win the next election, going to cause enormous problems for Keir Starmer in terms of, is he going to appoint a large number of new peers to balance the numbers up? Because if he does, he's going to be pushing at 900 members of the House of Lords. And that's why I think the fact that the Prime Minister has that unrestrained patronage power means that the Prime Minister can damage the reputation of the place through their appointments, and they can even do it deliberately. And I think some people allege that David Cameron was doing that. I certainly think it's a more plausible proposition that Boris Johnson was doing that through the nature of his appointments. It's not in the Prime Minister's interest for the House of Lords to be respected and strong, because it challenges the government. But it's in the interests of Parliament, and it's in the interests of the country, that we should have a House of Lords that can stand up and make serious challenges to the government and properly scrutinise. So the system of prime ministerial appointments really does need sorting out now. That's the most urgent.
Yeah, I note that Baroness Owen made her maiden speech this week. I wonder if that's perhaps who we could be talking about there.
We've got a new chair of the House of Lords Appointments Commission who's just taking over, and she was questioned in a House of Commons committee a few weeks ago about this and said that she wanted the House of Lords Appointments Commission to have more powers to oversee the appointment system. And I think that's quite right. We've done polling that shows that actually that's what the British public want as well. They very strongly want independent oversight of the appointments process, not just prime ministerial patronage. And this is years overdue, a reform of that kind.
Obviously, yeah. That doesn't extend to our two wonderful peers on the podcast. They would obviously pass.
Of course, or indeed today.
They would pass all the quality control. That's all we've got time for this week. But you can read all the latest on the big stories in Westminster at politicshome.com, and keep right up to date by subscribing to our 7-day week newsletters by clicking on the link on our homepage. Thanks to my brilliant guests, Professor Meg Russell, Baroness Kate Fall, and Lord Ed Vasey. Thanks all again for listening. Please subscribe wherever you podcast and leave us a review. If you want to get in touch, then reach out to us on Twitter @politicshome or email us via news@politicshome.com. But for now, I've been Alan Tolhurst, and this has been The Rundown.